We begin by acknowledging the land that we're on, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat peoples, and the Mississaugas of New Credit, and the treaty between the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe of the Dish with One Spoon Treaty that covers this territory as a gathering place, Toronto as a gathering place, to be shared amongst communities to reap the benefits of the lavish land here, and especially the waters. We also acknowledge the water that we're on, Niganigichigami, or Ontario, the Lake of Shining Waters. But tonight, as part of our water festival, we're delighted to have with us scholar, writer, you've probably read from him in Toronto Star, Dr. Stephen Sharper, here with us from University of Toronto. And his work is incredible, and he really brings together the human and the world, really, in creation, and talks about the ways that people are also affected by things like climate change and access to things like clean water. So he's a wonderful scholar, and he works out of the School of the Environment at the University of Toronto, St. George Campus, and the Department of Anthropology at the University of Toronto at Mississauga. And his most recent book is called For Earth's Sake, Towards a Compassionate Ecology, and that came out in 2013. And a lot of his work has been also on Laudato Si, the papal encyclical about the environment. So he really works on theology and ecology, and what does it mean to be a thoughtful Christian thinking about our relationship with creation. And he obtained his PhD from McGill University in the 90s. So we're delighted to have him here with us, and it's a huge privilege to hear him speak. And those that have heard him before in our community said, oh my gosh, I can't believe you brought him back. We can't wait. So thank you so much for being with us here as we think about our relationship with water, both individually and collectively, and our relationship to the waters of this area.
Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you, Evan. And thank you for coming out. There are other things that you could be doing this evening, and it's a delight actually to see an interest in exploring this interconnection of water and this flow from commodity to gift. Now, I have to make one clarification, and I hope I don't have to make this much longer, historically speaking, but my name, of course, is Stephen Sharper, not Stephen Harper. And the SC in front of my last name, very important. So as history changes, maybe I won't have to make that clarification for too much longer. As Lee graciously mentioned, I teach and walk in the area of environment, social justice, faith, and social justice liberation pathways at the University of Toronto and elsewhere. And when we look at our contemporary moment in time, socially, ecologically, and culturally, it can be a very challenging time, sometimes even paralyzing in terms of the data. So it's important that we maintain a sense of humor. Okay, so this attempted humor involves the price of gas in France. Can you see anything there? Okay, great. Okay, so during the major climate change talks in Paris, when all the headlines were about all the world leaders, something else happened that didn't get a lot of notice, and that was a theft in the Louvre. Now, there was this mastermind thief. He planned to steal some of these incredible paintings during this international COP meeting on climate change. After serious, careful planning, he was able to disarm the security system, get past that, steal some of the world's leading paintings, and make it safely to his van. It looked like the perfect heist. But he was captured only two blocks away when his van ran out of gas. Unbelievable. So he's arrested, and the cops cannot fathom this. How could you mastermind such an incredible heist and make such a stupid error? And the thief replied, Monsieur, that is the reason I stole the paintings. You see, I had no money. And I had no money in order to, you can see where this is going, in order to buy the gas. In order to make the van go. Sorry. That's the attempt at humor. Okay. Now, here's a challenge. See if you have the gall to tell this to any of your friends. Now, I figure I can get away with it because I'm old and gray and I have nothing to lose. Look. That's it. Okay. Just the attempt at humor. Okay. Well, part of what I wanted to do today in talking with you about water is to put the water conversation in a larger ecological context, a context that is as much about our natural world as it is about our intellectual and cosmological and worldview spaces. So to help us get into that framework of situating where we are with water in terms of larger environmental worldview currents, I'm going to share another humorous clip, but there's something a little more significant happening. This is a clip from The Great Outdoors, a little Canadian content. Some of you may have seen this 1988 film. It features two local actors from Ontario, John Candy, who went to Neil McNeil High School in Scarborough and was taught by Ted Schmidt, among others, a social justice advocate from the Catholic faith, and also Dan Aykroyd, also from southern Ontario. Now, the backdrop to this particular scene is the John Candy character named Chet has just gone to this beautiful bucolic cottage where he, as a boy, spent time with his dad. He and his family have a week's vacation, and they're just looking so forward to relaxing. Unbeknownst to them, their obnoxious, venal, and lascivious brother-in-law, Roman, played by Dan Aykroyd, along with his family, invade their space and surprise them. And they're going to be there a whole week. So this is the ensuing conversation as Chet and Roman are gazing out over a beautiful watery vista. See what each of them sees when they look at that gaze as a kind of question of a worldview and the place of the human within that space. Okay, so here we go.
And in the whole week you'll be here. Okay. Oh, wow. Just something.
So anyway, you're an intelligent man.
Thank you.
Make a good living?
Not bad.
Get a good life?
Pretty good.
Answer me one question.
Sure.
Why the hell would you want to come up to a plant-infested no-man's land like this and live like a barbarian for a week?
You wouldn't understand.
Try me.
I have great memories of this country when I was a kid, you know, and I used to come up here with my dad, and I want the boys to have the same memories. I would look around you, Roman, for God's sakes. This is beautiful country here. Take a good look.
I'll tell you what I see when I look out there, if you want to know.
Hey, yeah, I'm curious.
I see the underdeveloped resources of northern Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. I see a syndicated development consortium exploiting over $1.5 billion in forest products. I see a paper mill, and if the strategic metals are there, a mining operation. A greenbelt between the condos on the lake and a waste management facility, focusing on the newest rage in toxic waste, medical refuse. Infected bandages, body parts, IV tubing, contaminated glassware, entrails, syringes, fluid, blood, low-grade radioactive waste, all safely contained, sunken in the lake, and sealed for centuries. Now, I ask you, what do you see?
I just see trees.
Well, no one ever accused you of having the grand vision.
Nope.
Maybe it's all for the best, while the ambitious scramble for wealth and power, the Chet Ripleys of the world are just able to lay back and casually stroll along life's path. I mean that as a compliment.
Oh, thanks.
The rest of us are all probably going to die of heart attacks and strokes long before you.
I hope so. Isn't that great? Gee, just to see a bunch of people drop that you hate. That would be something else, I'm telling you.
Okay. A kind of a clash of visions of nature and worldviews. And we're going to see another one, an historical one. And this is Rachel Carson. And this is DDT that you see here. It's being sprayed on children as they eat. This was for the U.S. Department of Agriculture promotional film for DDT. Here it's being sprayed on children as they swim. And here it's being sprayed, and this was a government program to spray not only private agricultural lands, but public lands. And when a plane such as that flew over a bird sanctuary in the eastern seaboard of the United States, The curator of that sanctuary, Ms. Olga Hutchins, saw thousands of birds going into toxic shock and die. And she wrote a letter to, at that time, a famous writer, Rachel Carson, and said, please, can you help us? And Rachel Carson later said, it was in answer to that letter that Silent Spring was born. And the notion of Silent Spring is, imagine a spring bereft of birdsong. Imagine these spring mornings when you get up and you open the window, or you go outside and you hear the robins and you hear warblers and the yellow-bellied sapsuckers, and you hear all these birds migrating and some staying through here and singing their songs of the morning. Imagine none of that, because they've all perished because of pesticide use or chemical use. This was the nightmare thought, Silent Spring, that helped animate this book that came out in 1962 and really, many people say, helped change the way we look at the world. Up until this time, there was a great rush to embrace a chemically based, industrially robust approach to agriculture using pesticides and other chemicals after World War II. DDT was used during World War II to fight typhus and was very effective in fighting it. After the war, it was seen that it could be used to kill pests in agricultural lands, and it was used heavily. And this became a kind of chemical government industrial complex, where the governments were now encouraging this to be used all over. For example, spraying for gypsy moths and other mosquitoes and pests using DDT. So the government agencies were buying it in bulk, and this became a very big industry. But people such as Rachel Carson were beginning to see the underside. And they were seeing what was happening to many species, particularly as DDT entered water systems and was consumed by various aquatic life. It biomagnified as it went up the food chain. So the larger fish, which were then eaten by ospreys, eagles, and other raptors, led to the almost near extinction of several of these species. The American bald eagle went into rapid decline, as did the peregrine falcon, because their eggs could not come to term. Their shells were so gossamer-like, they couldn't survive till the chick was hatched, and therefore a massive decline directly owing to these chemicals, and DDT being one of the main culprits. Here we're going to see a spokesperson for American Cyanamid, a large chemical company, Dr. Robert White Stevens, who was very opposed to Rachel Carson's work. When Rachel Carson's book was first in gestation, there was a lot of opposition. Some of you might remember this. So she had been with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as editor-in-chief. She wrote a book called The Sea Around Us in the early 50s that became a bestseller. She was able to retire from the federal government and be a full-time writer. So she was an established writer at this point. When she got the letter from Olga Hutchins, she wrote to Reader's Digest saying, I want to do an article on DDT use. They turned her down. As she did more research, she realized, actually, this probably should be a book. And she went to her publisher at Houghton Mifflin. They said, yes, let's go with this. Houghton Mifflin received menacing letters from the Velsicol Chemical Company, saying that she was not a researcher, she was an activist, that she was an hysterical woman, and that she was probably allied with communist forces. Now, for those of you who don't remember that era or weren't born at that time, that's like calling someone a terrorist, right? I mean, that was the nomenclature of the enemy, right? Communist. Houghton Mifflin looked at the letter and responded, we have every confidence in Rachel Carson. She's been vetted. She's an established author. We're going ahead. The book progresses. Just before publication, the New Yorker magazine does pre-publication excerpts. After the first one appears, they get the menacing letter from Velsicol, again threatening lawsuits for the same reasons. They said, no, we're going ahead, and they continued. After that, the book was published. It became a Book of the Month bestseller, and it created a firestorm in the agricultural and chemical industries. And one of the chief spokespersons against the book was Dr. Robert White Stevens. In the year 1962, when this was published, he gave over 82 public lectures around North America against it and appeared on radio and television speaking against this. So you're going to hear him here speak about what the modern scientist and the modern chemist sees as his or her role, vis-a-vis what Rachel Carson sees as her role. You will then see Rachel Carson speak about her vision of the human interrelationship with non-human nature. And again, see the worldviews clash.
Perhaps the fulcrum over which the argument chiefly rests is that Ms. Carson maintains that the balance of nature is a major force in the survival of man, whereas the modern chemist, the modern biologist, the modern scientist believes that man is steadily controlling nature.
Now, to these people, apparently the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene. Well, you might just as well assume that you could repeal the law of gravity. The balance of nature is built of a series of interrelationships between living things and between living things and their environment.
So you see that juxtaposition. The role of the modern scientist, according to Dr. Robert White Stevens, is to steadily control nature, the human as the controller of nature. And her approach of the balance of nature and finding our place in that interrelated balance. Many cite this as the beginning of the modern environmental movement. She then is brought in front of many committees to talk about this. And what we just saw was her on a television program, CBS Reports, with Eric Severide. They went into her home and interviewed her. That was a snippet from that broadcast. 2 weeks before that broadcast, CBS News put out their promotion and their publicity on it. They received 1,000 mimeograph letters. Now, some of you, like me, might remember the Gestetner machines in the primary school with the purple ink, and you love to go in there and smell it and get the fumes. You know, before the Xerox, this was the Gestetner. So it was 1,000 one of those Gestetner mimeographed letters. And one of the producers said, we never had that much mail on any issue we ever covered. And it said, be careful with this thing. She's not really who she said she is. 2 days before that broadcast, all the advertisers pulled the plug on their ads. All the sponsors dropped out. They did not want this to air. But CBS News, at that time not owned by General Electric or a larger conglomerate, went ahead. They felt this was important. Watching at home that night in his living room was Senator Abraham Ribicoff, a Democrat of Connecticut. Now, I'm not sure if he read the book. He may not have read the New Yorker magazine, but he saw her. And the next day, he called for hearings on DDT in the U.S. Senate. This led to the banning of DDT both in the United States and in Canada. Some say it also led to the first Clean Air and Clean Water Act. It began a movement of environmental protection at a federal level. And here, you're going to see Rachel Carson testifying to the U.S. Senate. And again, her language is fascinating because she's a biologist, and she's an author of great talent, not a politician and not a lawyer. And yet she's articulating these ideas so they can be heard by lawmakers and they can tie it into the threads of American democracy. Here we go.
I hope this committee will give serious consideration to a much neglected problem, that of the right of the citizen to be secure in his own home against the intrusion of poisons applied by other persons. I speak not as a lawyer, but as a biologist and as a human being. But I strongly feel that this is or should be one of the basic human rights.
It's sad but important to mention that she's struggling with cancer at this time. She's wearing a wig. She had gone through intense chemotherapy, and she dies in 1964, less than 2 years after the publication of Silent Spring. So she's doing this while very ill and had an incredible tenacity and strength of will to do this while she was being attacked from many sides, supported from many sides as well. And I think this is important for us to remember as people of faith, as we embrace the environmental movement. because many valiant people, such as Rachel Carson, could not lean on broad-based religious or church support in 1962. This was not an issue for many churches in 1962, and the churches are often Johnny-come-latelys to such movements. When they do come, they can bring an energy and vigor and a teaching power. But when they're not there, it leaves a void. And so it's important for us, I think, to remember as we embrace these movements that there's been a chain of courage that some of us may have been involved with as individuals, but maybe not institutionally. A chain of courage from people at the New Yorker, at Houghton Mifflin, at CBS News, and later at the Kennedy administration. The Kennedy administration, rather than stiff-arming Rachel Carson, welcomed her through the Secretary of the Interior, Udall, who saw his marching orders being given by Rachel Carson. These excerpts are from a documentary called Rachel Carson's Silent Spring from the American Experience. It's a PBS documentary. And those of you at U of T, we have it at U of T Library, and I think parts of it are online too, so you can tap into this. But it's an interesting, important story, but for people of faith, I think it's also a challenge. And part of water issues for me come into a number of categories, and one is water and justice. And again, some of the advocates from an earlier time, some very courageous women such as Lois Gibbs of Love Canal, were acting out of a sense of decency when their water was contaminated. Some of you might remember Lois Gibbs, who was a housewife in Love Canal near Niagara Falls, in this suburban development where people started getting sick dramatically. When tests were done of the drinking water, they found almost every chemical they could identify in the drinking water. And kids were developing cancers, and people were getting very sick and developing cancer, etc. This woman, who didn't have advanced degrees, who had a commitment to the health of her family and community, became a champion for clean water. And you saw that image with her and Jimmy Carter. President Carter invited her to the White House after years of her advocacy and declared a Superfund site to clean up these toxic waste sites. Again, a woman acting out of a sense of decency and love for her community and a love for clean water. But again, not always accompanied on her journey through established faith communities. And so this became an issue of justice for the people of Love Canal, indeed the United States, who were drinking toxic water. We also have experienced this notion of environmental racism and environmental justice around water issues. And here Robert Bullard and Benjamin Chavez of the Christian community, the United Church of Christ in the United States, Benjamin Chavez is part of that community and wrote an early document looking at where the toxic waste sites were in Middle America, the Mid-Atlantic states, in one section of that area. And he found that there was a correlation between toxic waste sites and residences with people of color living in them, African Americans, Hispanics, indigenous peoples, that there was a preponderance of toxic waste sites in marginalized economic areas with people of color. And so he began to talk about this as environmental racism, as did Robert Bullard, a sociologist who wrote some well-known books on this, Dumping in Dixie, Confronting Environmental Racism, etc. On this topic, there's a beautiful book that deals with this in a gentle way, and it's by Jonathan Kozel, Amazing Grace, on the spiritual lives of children in Mott Haven, New York. Mott Haven is the poorest congressional district in the United States, in the South Bronx. And he talks about walking with a little boy, Cliffy, who's 7 years old. All the children in this area, mainly African American, have puffers. Most of them have asthma. And he finds out the reason. His little Cliffy is saying, "Hey, do you know what's going on over there? They're burning bodies there." "Yeah." Well, he finds out from Reverend Overall, one of the ministers in the area, that that's an incinerator for medical waste. Exactly what we heard Roman talking about. You know what's going in there through Roman's description. This incinerator was originally going to be sited on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, but the residents successfully fought it, and it ends up in the poorest congressional district of the United States, largely African American. For this kind of perspective, this isn't an accident. Where is the contamination going? This is where it's going.